federal government, we're not exactly sure yet. We know that we'll get less money from the state of Illinois. And over the last couple of years, we have tried the best we can to cope with that and do it in ways that doesn't affect the service. But the only way that we can continue to do that and provide you with the kind of service you've come to rely on is if you, who are a listener who values the station, will step up and say, yes, I believe in it enough so that I'm willing to support it with my dollars. And this is one of the times during the year that we ask that. We're now raising money that we will spend on programming in the next fiscal year, the one that begins July 1st. And we need to have the money in the bank to pay for next year's programs, and that's what we're working on. So if it's time for you to renew, if you're a current supporter, if it's time for you to renew, you can do that by calling 244-9455. Or if you've never given before, this would be a great time to join in this group that we call the Friends of WYLL, again, by making a pledge. 244-9455. Maybe you could make a contribution at the basic level, which is $40, or maybe you could give more. That's up to you. What is important is that you are a supporter, a financial supporter, in whichever way you can, of WYLL, because the future of the station really relies on you. So once again, we have volunteers who will take the call. It'll take about 2 minutes, and we would appreciate it. 244-9455 is the number to call. If you like, you can also go to our website and pledge online. That address is will.uiuc.edu. And we thank you for your support. Well, let me again introduce our guest for this part of Focus 580, Pedro Sanchez. He's Director of Tropical Agriculture and is Senior Research Scholar at the Earth Institute of Columbia University in New York City. He also serves as co-chair of the Hunger Task Force of the Millennium Project. That's an advisory body to the UN. From 1991 until 2000, he served as Director General of the World Agroforestry Center, headquartered in Nairobi, Kenya. He is also Professor Emeritus of Soil Science and Forestry at North Carolina State University. He was named a MacArthur Foundation Fellow in 2003, and he received the World Food Prize in 2002. In his professional career, he's been dedicated to improving the management of tropical soils to achieve food security, to reduce rural poverty, and at the same time, protect and enhance the environment. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be talking a little bit later today, not much later, at noon today, at the ACES Library Information and Alumni Center, talking about this subject that we'll be discussing here, the Millennium Development Goals on Hunger. Questions are welcome as we talk. As always, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks if you'd like to call in. We do also have a toll-free line good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are certainly welcome. You will come right here to this program. No one will expect you to pledge. It would be nice, but it is not required. Thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it. Perhaps first, we just might, for people who aren't familiar with the whole idea of the Millennium Development Goals, talk for just a second about what these goals are. There's a set of them. They deal with different areas. But overall, the idea is to reduce poverty, reduce hunger, and aid in developing less developed parts of the world.
Well, David, is all that, the Millennium Development Goals were signed up by all the leaders of the world at the September 2000 Millennium Summit at the UN. So all our presidents and prime ministers have signed on our behalf. So they are our goals. They have a definite deadline, the year 2015, 10 years from now to do it. And there are 8 goals, and they're dealing with cutting absolute poverty. That means people who make less than a dollar a day in half, cutting people who are hungry in half, cutting child and maternal mortality by 2/3, achieving 100% primary school enrollment, ending gender discrimination, ensuring environmental sustainability, cutting the number of people who don't have access to clean water and sanitation by half, improving trade, upgrading slums, and making a partnership between the rich and the poor countries to achieve all these goals.
Mm-hmm. Specifically to talk about the goal on reducing hunger, perhaps first we talk a little bit about where things stand right now. Over the past couple of decades, there has been some reduction in the levels of hunger around the world, perhaps not as much as we would hope for. And there are particular regions of the world where it does continue to be a problem. How, at this point, how are we doing?
We're doing worse than 3 or 5 years before. Hmm. At present, there are about 852 million people who don't know where their next meal is coming from. About half of them are in smallholder farms in Africa and Asia. 20% of them are the rural landless people. 20% only are the urban hungry, and the remaining 10% are the people who depend on forestry or pastoralists or fisher folks. So, in the last few decades, hunger has decreased from about 35% of humanity to about 18%, which is right now. Still, 18% is just too many. That's almost about one out of every six people of us who are living in conditions that are really difficult to believe and understand.
Mm-hmm. I had an opportunity to look at a report looking at this and also looking at recommendations on how to deal with the problem and how to move toward it. And I think one of the points the report makes is worth talking about, and that is that there are different kinds of hunger, and that when we see a crisis someplace, that does get some attention, at least for a short period of time, from the world's media, and people do pay attention. And that perhaps that's the kind of thing, when you talk about hunger, that's the kind of thing people think about. But that's not the real large part of the problem. It's a hunger that is more chronic, and that, in fact, might go to issues like, well, what sort of basic nutritional level do people have? How does that relate to their health? How does that relate to mm-hmm. development?
Well, that's true. Only 10% of those 852 million hungry people suffer from what we call acute hunger. Those are people who are at the edge of starvation. Mm-hmm. They're usually in refugee camps or in areas affected by war or catastrophic droughts and so on. Darfur in the Sudan is the biggest example of that. But that's only 10%. 90% are the chronically hungry people who suffered silently, who go through hungry months. They eat very little for 3 to 7 months of the year. They die in droves. They die at the rate of about 200,000 people in Africa every month, because not of starvation, but of malnutrition-related diseases such as diarrhea, such as malaria. People get weaker from HIV/AIDS and so on. So basically, we have a silent tsunami going on every month. Every month, 200,000 African, mostly children, die of hunger-related causes, and it's about the same number that died on December 26 in the Asian tsunami.
Mm. Perhaps I should just make sure that I give our telephone number again here for people who would like to call in on the program. We certainly encourage questions, as always, here on the show. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So the numbers are similar, but not quite the same. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And guest again, our guest this morning is Pedro Sanchez. He is Director of Tropical Agriculture and Senior Research Scholar at the Earth Institute of Columbia University in New York City. Perhaps we could talk a little bit about the causes of hunger. I think depending upon who you ask and what their particular discipline is and how they come at the problem, you might get different answers from different sorts of people. Why do we have this problem?
We have this large number of hungry people in the world because there isn't enough food produced specifically in Africa. There isn't enough food to go around. And so there's a total scarcity of food. In other countries, like in India, there's a mountain of food there. There is India is exporting food now. And still India has 200 million people who are hungry. And that's a matter of lack of opportunity. lack of employment opportunity, lack of opportunities to make good money being farmers. So it's an issue of economic growth. So in one case in Africa, it's largely an issue of shortage of food, while in Asia there's plenty of food, but there are some people who are too poor to be able to buy the food.
Yeah. So some places it is a production issue. Other places the issue is poverty. It's economic. So it may be one or the other of those things depending on where it is that you're looking at around the world.
That's correct. That's correct.
Well, you and overall, one of the things that you argue, and I'm sure that other people argue, is first of all that this is a solvable problem to this goal that has been set out by as one of the Millennium Development Goals to cut world hunger in half by 2015. You believe that it actually can be done.
It actually can be done. There's no question about it. If we set our minds to it, it cannot be done if we continue with business as usual.
Well, let's go on then and talk about what it is that you think and other people who work in this area think it's the way to approach it. And you have made a number of recommendations, things that have to do with what the wealthy countries of the world can do, what governments in developing countries can do, things that have to do with issues of development, things that have to do with issues of boosting production. Perhaps the place to start is with the number one recommendation, and that is to go from talking about doing something to actually doing it. And certainly in the past, as this report points out, that the governments of the world have made commitments to deal with this issue before and more than once. So how do you get from saying this is a problem and we're going to do something about it to doing something about it?
Well, we certainly don't need any more commitments because all the commitments have been made. So it's time to go from commitment to action. And by that, I mean in the hungry countries, they have to put high priority on getting rid of hunger. And surprisingly, that doesn't happen in all the hungry countries. They have to get their financing strategies right to meet all the Millennium Development Goals. They have to have better systems of accountability for the money they received from the rich countries. From the rich countries' point of view, we promised the world, all of us, that we would spend 0.7% of our gross national product in developing aid. And right now, the whole rich countries as a whole are spending about 0.3%. The U.S. is at the bottom. It's about 0.13%, even though our president, as recently as 2 years ago in Mexico, promised to go to 0.7%. And to me, it's some people think that foreign aid doesn't work. And I like to address that. Let's take food aid, put food aid on the side. Food aid is only important for that 10% of the acutely hungry who are dying and who should get food at whatever cost because we don't want people to die like that. But for the other 90%, food aid is generally a bad thing because it creates dependencies. It doesn't allow the potential of the local agricultural people to produce more food, to produce more balanced food, more than corn-soy mixed, to have enough minerals in vegetables and vitamins in fruits and vegetables and so on. So, but the rest of the so-called foreign aid, you take food aid out, you take military aid out, which is a political issue, the rest of it has worked and has worked very well. I started my career in Latin America when we were giving aid to Brazil and South Korea and Mexico and China, and all these countries now are our customers. And we have found out that for every dollar of increase in agricultural production in developing countries, those countries end up importing 73 cents worth of goods from rich countries like the United States. And even part of that is food. So we want to get these people out of hunger, these countries out of hunger and out of poverty, so they can be our trading partners. And this is a very important part. But our problems, I'll just make an analogy here. Mm-hmm. Let's assume there is a forest fire. And we send, as foreign aid, we send three firemen to cut down this forest fire. And they come back and says, we can't do it. And then people say, well, foreign aid doesn't work. What we needed was to send 30 firemen to do it right and to have a system of firefighting and a setup for the next year and the next year so one could be prepared and be suitably equipped to look for future forest fires. So what I'm saying is that what we've done has been too little in terms of magnitude and for too short a time usually. You need to do this in the long run. The Millennium Project is calling for no less than a full attack, not pilot projects, but a fully funded attack on the end of poverty and hunger and disease in the poor world. And that's going to be sort of like a Marshall Plan. And working first with the countries that are really interested, and hopefully the countries that are not equipped or interested to do that because they're very corrupt or because they have very different policies. I'm talking like corrupt country like Zimbabwe or a country out of the blue like North Korea, can work with those. But you can certainly work with Ethiopia and Kenya and Uganda and Tanzania and countries that are reasonably well-governed, and they will certainly respond. I think we can get it done that if we set our minds to it and if we get the political will. And I think the political will is increasingly gaining in most countries in the world.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation, and we'd welcome others if you have questions for our guest, Dr. Pedro Sanchez. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have the toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, we'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Chicago on our toll-free line, line number 4, right there. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm sure that your answer about the causes of hunger was just a starting point for us, because when you just look at production, we know that the problems of production have been affected by warfare and low-intensity warfare, and also the problem of debt. The continent of Africa as a whole throughout the 80s and the 90s was paying to the Western world more money and for interest on their loans than they were receiving in development aids. So you had a non-starter there as far as the continent as a whole and individual governments to do anything, because there was no money. So the debt problem is something that really has to be looked at. The other problem with low-intensity warfare is that we know that affects food production because it causes dislocation, and it also interrupts growing seasons and food preservation, all of which is leads to that long-term hunger. So I know we can't just talk about production and say there's no production and leave it at that. I think really to help people understand, I'm sure you want to talk more about these problems of both debt and war. And as we see what's happening now in Iraq, there are more children in Iraq suffering from malnutrition now, 2 years into our occupation, than there were prior, even under the sanctions of the UN. So we need to look at very specific problems such as war and debt.
Correct. Hunger is agriculture. Hunger is nutrition. Hunger is markets. Hunger is environment. Hunger is policies, and hunger is politics. So that encompasses all the things that you have said and many more. On the debt, we are in a ridiculous situation. We have knowingly lent countries billions of dollars for this aid when we know very well that they are not able to pay. So I think debt relief is correcting an obvious mistake. By all means, you should lend money to countries for development that already are middle-income countries that can pay, like India and Brazil and Mexico, let's say. But why lend money to a country like Kenya, which is one of the poorest countries in the world? And right now, Kenya is paying $500 million a year to service its debt and is getting $100 million a year in aid. So Kenya is a net exporter of aid as opposed to a net receiver of aid as it should be. You're absolutely right on that. It's an idea whose time has passed. We have to get rid of this stupid debt relief and in the future give grants and not loans as investment into these countries. A war, whether it's slow or whether it's cold or hot, you cannot do agricultural development. You cannot solve hunger when there is war. They're just incompatible. So for countries that are at war now, or there's not much, we're just going to have to wait until that settles down.
And I had another question. This was something that I read about Brazil. It's a kind of a depressing. I read that in Brazil there's two levels of poverty. There are people considered poor and there are people considered in misery. And I guess my question is, what level of poverty are we talking about that you're below poor and you're in misery? And how has the policies of the government, which I thought Lula's government's intention was to eradicate these levels of poverty, what do you see has been the stumbling block where, because we have a government which had the political will and has the economics and has ingenuity, what's been the stumbling blocks in Brazil?
Well, you're quite right that what we're dealing with is the people who would be called in misery. We're talking about the poverty that kills. The poverty kills you, literally. And that's why we have so many people who are dying. So Lula is addressing both issues, both types of poverty in their hunger Zero Hunger campaign, which I think is admirable. One of the things that impressed me the most about Lula is when its Ministry of Defense came up with a request of buying several tens or hundreds of millions of dollars of fighter jets to replenish the Air Force, and he said, no, I will put that money into fighting hunger. This is the first time a country has done that, and Brazil deserves our applause and admiration for doing that. If we could do here just a little bit of that, it would be marvelous.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. We are just about midway through this conversation in this first hour of Focus 580. And we will continue in just a moment here to talk with our guest, Pedro Sanchez, from Columbia University, from the Earth Institute there at Columbia University. We're talking about some of the progress that has been made and what we still need to do to meet the one of the UN Millennium Development Goals, that is that the goal to cut world hunger in half by the year 2015. Our guest on the program here, Dr. Sanchez, will be talking on this topic at noon today at the ACES Library Information and Alumni Center on the U of I campus. I'm sure anybody who was interested should feel welcome to stop by and hear what he has to say. One thing also that we just need to do right here, I feel a little bit, when we're talking about something as serious as world hunger, to take a moment to talk about our need here at WILL. It's a much smaller kind of a problem. If we're going to continue to have conversations like this on this station, we do need to encourage people to support with their contributions, WILL. So some small amount of money will help to keep us going. And we do want to keep up with our progress. This is the last weekday here that we'll have the opportunity to talk to you about this station and how important your support is. We'll wrap up at about noontime tomorrow, our spring fundraising effort. Our Dave Teal, I believe, is in Pledge Central. Now, he is the program director for WILL Television, and a lot of TV folks have been nice enough to come and give some of their time here this week as we encourage people to support the station. And I think we particularly want to mention, Dave, we do have a challenge going we'd like to try to meet.
Yes, indeed. We have a challenge from a listener in Urbana who wants to encourage a great response on the final weekday morning of the fund drive. She will make an extra gift of $250 when we hear from 15 pledges during Focus 580 today. So we've got this hour, well, basically about an hour and a half until noon. She thinks that that David, you are an amazing interviewer, and WILL listeners are fortunate to have your program. And certainly, I think we all agree that with that here. So we'd like to get the phones ringing right now at 244-9455. You can be the first person toward this challenge and an extra $250 this morning.
All right. That's great. Well, thank you, Dave. That would really help us out. We're raising the money that we'll spend on programming next year. Our next fiscal year begins on July 1st. We have a pretty good idea how much money we're going to need, but the other sources of funding that we've had in the past are just pretty uncertain. So the only place that we can go to make up that difference is to listeners. And if you tune in to this show every day and other public radio programs we have on this station, and they help you get a little bit better handle on the world and the challenges that we all face every day, well, this show, this station does indeed need your support. So we hope, if you haven't done it yet, maybe at the end of the program today, maybe at the end of this hour, at some time today, here as we're winding down this spring, you'll help us out and give us a call and make a pledge. And again, that number is 244-9455. Let me just again very quickly introduce our guest, Dr. Pedro Sanchez. He is Director of Tropical Agriculture and Senior Research Scholar at the Earth Institute of Columbia University in New York City. He serves as co-chair of the Hunger Task Force of the Millennium Project. That's an advisory body to the United Nations. He also served as Director General of the World Agroforestry Center in Nairobi, Kenya, from 1991 until 2001. He is also Professor Emeritus of Soil Science and Forestry at North Carolina State University. He has various times of his life lived in the Philippines, in Peru, in Colombia, in Kenya. His professional career has been dedicated to improving the management of tropical soils, and he is author of a book that's a standard text on the subject, Properties and Management of Soils of the Tropics. He's also written a lot of scientific papers, and we'll be giving a talk on this very subject on the U of I campus at noon today at the ACES Library Information and Alumni Center. So you should feel welcome to stop by if you're interested in hearing more from him. This is part of the ACES Global Connect series, and we've been fortunate enough to have some of these folks on the program here to talk. Another question that has to do with one of the goals that the Task Force on Hunger that you've been associated with has recommended. Over time, we've had people here on this program from the United Nations and from other non-governmental organizations that are particularly issued with development and interested in issues of development and hunger and so forth. And one of the recommendations you say is that we really need to improve public awareness of these issues and strengthen those organizations that do advocacy. Now, I know this is something we've talked about. This is something I'm sure people have heard about. I guess it would surprise me that there would be people who would not be aware that this program that this problem exists. Do you think that is the case, that awareness generally of the issue of world hunger is not what it should be?
Oh, I think it's definitely the case. There is some dim awareness there that when you see the hungry, the starving Ethiopian child with flies in his eyes in a refugee camp, who said, "Oh my God, there's our horrible hunger due to wars and droughts and so on." And there's a general sense that you can do anything about it. And so we pass on to the next thought. I think what we should be aware of is the hunger problem is enormous, that the extreme catastrophic situations like the refugee camps and so on is just 10% of the problem. 90% of the problem is silent hunger. And that there is a tremendous amount that can be done. We have the science and the technology and the policies on how to eliminate hunger. The world, we know how to do it. What we need is a political will and wherewithal to do it. But we know that it can be done.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about that. Some questions that will draw on your background as a soil scientist, and acknowledging all of those things that the previous caller talked about as being particular, serious and difficult issues that have to do with politics, economics, the commitments of the developed world to try to provide aid, the commitments of the developing world to make the commitments to their own people. Having said all of that, all those things are important. Back at the beginning of the discussion, you did say that indeed some places around the world, one of the big issues is production, and that is that, and the fact that more food could be produced given certain sorts of things. I mean, can you talk about that? What might be done technically to enhance production and deal with that issue?
In Africa, the entry points are improving soil health and improving water management. Soils are sick because they have been depleted of nutrients, mainly nitrogen and phosphorus. They come out on their crop harvests, and they're not returned back with fertilizers or manures or anything like that. Water, rain-fed water, is wild. There is either too much or too little, has not been controlled. Africa doesn't have the wherewithal for large-scale irrigation in terms of its geography, so it has to be small-scale irrigation. So what we are recommending is investing in the front end of the food chain, basically in improving soils, improving water, improving seeds that go into the soil, as opposed to investing in the tail end of the food chain, which is food aid.
Yeah. This maybe gives an opportunity to ask a question about some of the criticisms that have been raised in the past when the developed world has tried to foster agriculture in less developed countries and has done that by providing a wide array of modern inputs. The criticism is that then what happens is in your developing countries that they become dependent on those inputs, on seed, on fertilizer, on machinery, and that it fails to draw on indigenous practices that might make sense in sort of lower level, lower tech kind of inputs. Assuming you think that has been a problem in the past, how do we avoid that in the future?
By combining the local knowledge, the indigenous knowledge, if you wish, which is not perfect. There's some local knowledge, pieces of local knowledge that are wrong, and a lot of them that are right. But you combine the local knowledge with the scientific knowledge, which also isn't perfect. There's some pieces of scientific knowledge that are wrong and some pieces that are right. But working together and starting working with farming communities as opposed to get your ideas in a laboratory with your white coat on is the way to do it. Start working with them. What we're proposing are some things that are basically similar. Farming is similar everywhere. We need fertilizers. We need nutrients. We need improved seeds. But where they come is a different story. In Africa, we're using a lot of what we call fertilizer trees. These are nitrogen-fixing trees. These are legume trees. It's just like soybeans or peanuts here. They're the family. Legumes are the family of trees that have the capacity to take inert nitrogen from the air. We breathe an atmosphere of 78 nitrogen anywhere in the world. And these legumes, plants, have the capacity of transforming that into active nitrogen. The other way you do that is with a chemical process that makes ammonia fertilizer. And it's basically the same idea. Fertilizers are extremely expensive in Africa. They cost anywhere from 2 to 6 times as much at the farm gate in Africa than at the farm gate in Illinois. Still, they're very, very important. But we're trying to do a little bit of a bypass when it comes to nitrogen fertilizers by having farmers planting those fertilizer trees in their corn crop. They don't compete with the corn. During the dry season, they grow very, very fast, very deep roots. And they fix about 100 to 200 pounds of nitrogen per acre, which are put right there where the leaf drops. And then you plant the corn again, and then you get some tremendous results. Phosphorus fertilizers, you have to get them out of a fertilizer bag. And improved seeds, hybrid seeds, the best seeds that science can buy, that science can develop, and that people can buy for local conditions is essential. So we recommend investments. We recommend subsidizing these investments. For some reason, development agencies do not recommend farm subsidies in Africa, while we subsidize our farmers here and in Europe at the tune of $1 billion a day. So I think we should also consider subsidizing our farmers, our most poorest farmers, so they could afford this expensive fertilizer and other things like that. Investing in the front end, we know that corn yields, the main food crop, is corn. Corn yields can be increased by a factor of 2 to 3 times, 200 to 300%. When these technologies are done, technologies that the local farmers know, appreciate, they know how to do it, and it has been done, but at a very small scale. Only about 400,000 farmers are doing that. We need 10 million farmers, 20 million farmers to do that.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else here. We have a caller in Kankakee on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Only yesterday your servant was suggesting to Focus 580 that a new book by your director, Earth Institute's director, Jeffrey D. Sachs, The End of Poverty, Economic Possibilities for Our Time, would be an important new book that he'd like to see read and discussed. Today we have another member of Columbia University's Earth Institute on Focus 580. Dr. Sanchez, would you survey for us the work of the Institute generally, please?
Sure thing. And I think it's summarized in Jeff Sachs's book, The End of Poverty, a provocative title. I recommend that as reading, serious reading for anybody who's really interested in development. And all the things that I have said in this program so far, they've been in that book as well. The Earth Institute at Columbia University is a relatively new institute, and the idea is to bring together all the weight of all our sciences, biophysical sciences, biological sciences, physical sciences, social sciences, medical sciences, together to help humanity attain the Millennium Development Goals. That's what we're trying to do. So by working together, we're working at a village scale. We're working with villages and seeing how a typical impoverished African village can achieve all the Millennium Development Goals. I think some of that is in Jeff's book, actually, in the latter chapters there. But these villages, we ask them what they feel they need to accomplish the goals. The goals are no-brainers. Everybody understands them quickly. And they said we needed farm inputs, we needed a clinic, we needed mosquito nets for malaria, we need to do something about AIDS, but we don't know what, and we need access to water. So we're working in enabling the villages to do all that, and you should see the faces of those villagers and their sense of pride and empowerment that comes with it. So I recommend the book. I think it's bold. It has a new initiative. It is controversial, but the things have to be controversial because we have to get out of our rut in believing that things cannot be done. And I strongly believe with Jeff Sachs that it can be done, that we can win the war against world hunger and absolute poverty and disease and the rest of it.
Well, I thank the caller for his comments. We have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Pedro Sanchez. He is a soil scientist by his academic training, has been particularly interested in improving the management of tropical soils. He is director of tropical agriculture and senior research scholar at the Earth Institute of Columbia University in New York City. He also serves as co-chair of the Hunger Task Force of the Millennium Project. That's an advisory body to the United Nations. We're talking about what sort of progress has been made toward that Millennium Development Goal to cut world hunger in half by the year 2015. And he's here on the campus to talk about that very subject, and we'll be doing that at noontime today. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I mean, one of the things you were talking about a little bit before, I am sure that farmers all over the world would like to see their yields increased and are looking for ways to do that, and that some people think that biotechnology, genetically engineered seeds and plants can help also make them stronger, more productive, more disease resistant, deal better with drought and so forth. At the same time, there are a lot of people who are resistant to the idea of genetically engineered plants. We have seen that, for example, in some places in the developing world where they were really hurting and someone offered to give them aid. And it was in the form of products that had been genetically engineered. And they said, no, we don't want to have anything to do with that. Do you see a lot of resistance to bioengineered crops in the developing world? Is that a particular problem?
No, it is not a particular problem. African scientists, Asian scientists, Latin American scientists are all for biotechnology. Mm. Biotechnology for traits that are relevant to the poor. We're not too concerned about Roundup Ready soybeans there. That's not our problem there. Mm-hmm. But we really love BT corn and BT cotton because that cuts down on the amount of insecticide that you have to buy and apply also helps the environment by not having so much insecticides around. We're especially excited about advances in biotechnology that are beginning to come online now, like golden rice. Golden rice is a rice that has the precursors of vitamin A in the endosperm, the part of the rice that we eat. So that when that is put into full production, millions of Asian children will not go blind because of vitamin A deficiency. In Africa, we're working with a gene that will make corn an early maturing crop and a drought tolerant crop, and that will also increase production tremendously. Already, African scientists have bioengineered sweet potatoes with a very high vitamin A content. So these are things that are traits important to the poor. The biotech debate, scientifically, it's clear. There has been no evidence whatsoever of any kind of deleterious environmental effect of a genetically engineered crop. I think we have to be vigilant, and just because there hasn't been any up to now, there might not be in the future. But so far, nothing. So far, nothing that is scientifically valid. So it becomes a political question. Mm-hmm. And a political question has to be tackled politically. What happened in Zambia, where indeed food aid with genetically engineered probably BT corn from the States came in and was refused, was because some British NGOs told the government of Zambia that if they allow that to come in, they will not get more aid from the UK, even though they were not government agencies. So it was a blackmail threat, totally scientifically unfounded, and especially since this grain was going to be ground up and eaten as maize meal, sort of like what we call griots in southern United States. Well, it's kind of hard to think of what the importance of that was. African countries are making their own legislation on genetically engineered products, and they're being cautious. But I think maybe we had a very poor start in this country with bad public relations from the companies that promoted initially. But right now, even those companies like Monsanto are giving free intellectual property rights from countries in Africa to take advantage of the advances here. So it's a very good tool. I'm all for it because it's a very good scientific tool. And we'll always have some debates like this. I've been in Europe fairly recently. I was in Norway a couple of days ago. And I see the intensity of the allergy against biotech products diminishing in Europe.
One other question, and this is something that I'm sure we could spend some time talking about. We have maybe 3-4 minutes left.
Okay.
But I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about what I would call would be the ripple effects of increased production. What, for example, if you take a place like Africa and you can make it possible for people to produce more with perhaps with less effort, with fewer people having to be in the fields, with everything that comes from that, then in addition to the fact that the production goes up and the capacity to feed people goes up, what other things happen that are perhaps indirect results of the fact that you have done something to increase yield?
The ripple effects are enormous. I talked before about the ripple effect that for every dollar that a poor country increases in its agricultural production, they end up importing 73 cents worth of products from rich countries like the United States and Europe. So there's one ripple effect there, trade. The ripple effect of having people well-nourished means that they will learn. School feeding is a very large part of our program, something that's taken for granted in this country. But most kids in Africa go hungry all day while learning in school, and it's hard to learn when you're hungry. So you're going to improve education. You're going to attract girls to school. 40% of the 100 million primary school-age children in Africa, 40 million, are out of school right now, and most of those are girls. Those girls will become mothers very, very soon, perpetuating the cycle of poverty and misery, having low birth weight babies, and so on. With more agricultural production, they will stay in school because there will be school feeding. They will be educated on their reproductive physiology rights. They'll be educated on hygiene and on environment and so on. So the ripple effects are just enormous. Then you go from a subsistence economy, which is what we have right now, into a market economy in which farmers will begin to sell their products to supermarkets and so on. And there will be more people beginning to work in the beginning of agribusinesses, and more people will leave the farm and get into agribusiness. Agribusiness will get into manufacturing, eventually the information age, and we have the typical path of development that this country and other countries have gone. No, but no country has become a developed country without having a successful agricultural base. This is pretty obvious in the state of Illinois, but if I'm talking in the state of New York, some people think that food comes from supermarkets. So we have to educate them a little bit more. So the ripple effects are going to be enormous and are going to be positive. Yeah. We hope they don't get to the point that they're facing some of the problems we're facing here of nutrient pollution or nitrate pollution into the Mississippi River because of excessive fertilizer or manure applications. Our problem over there is the opposite, lack of nutrients. But we hope that we also learn from the problems encountered here.
Yeah. Particularly interesting, I think, is the ways in which the kind of development you're talking about touches the lives of women. I guess that's in large part because in so much of the rest of the world, women spend so much of – they're the farmers. They're the people who are spending the time in trying to produce the food.
That's correct. 80% of the farmers in Africa are women. Women not only do the farming, but they also do things that we take for granted here. They fetch firewood to cook. They go to the rivers and places like that with big buckets to get water to drink and to bathe. They are the caregivers. And their work calendar is about 16 hours a day. And and they seldom have the rights. They don't go to school as many, as I said. Most of the girls are out of school right now. They get married at a very young age. They have more children than they want and take care for. So and a special emphasis on women is not only the correct thing to do on moral and ethical grounds, but it's the correct thing to do on production grounds. So we are eliminating, for example, the need for women to spend 2 or 3 hours a day fetching water from the river by rooftop water harvesting, just getting the roofs to become reservoirs for water and other ways to harvest water. We're eliminating the need of women carrying enormous loads of firewood that I couldn't possibly carry by growing these nitrogen-fixing trees, fertilizer trees we call them, on the field that provide the fertilizer nitrogen, but you cut them and then they also provide enough firewood for a family to cook because they either cook with firewood or with dung. And at least there should be a good source of firewood here. Mm-hmm. So improving the lot of women is absolutely essential.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that because we've come to the end of the time. If you would like to hear more on the subject, achieving the Millennium Development Goals on hunger, our guest, Dr. Pedro Sanchez from Columbia University, will be talking at noon today on the U of I campus in the Monsanto Room of the ACES Library Information and Alumni Center, so you should feel welcome. Dr. Sanchez, winner of the 2002 World Food Prize, Director of Tropical Agriculture, and Senior Research Scholar at the Earth Institute of Columbia University in New York City. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Nice our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Funds also come from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. And, of course, a very, very important source of funds for WILL, the listeners to this station. Now is the time, if you have not yet made a contribution, to do it. 244-9455 is the number. Dave Teal is the program director for WILL-TV, and he is in Pledge Central. And, Dave, again, we want to remind people that we have a challenge going we're trying to meet tonight, or this morning.
That's right. Yeah, it's still morning. We're trying to hear from at least 15 pledgers during Focus 580. So during, of course, the current hour and, of course, the next hour. So by noon, 15 pledges during Focus. And when that happens, we have a listener in Urbana who will donate an extra $250 toward our pledge total. She thinks that David Inge here, of course, is a great, amazing interviewer, and that WILL listeners are fortunate to have Focus 580. And if you agree with both of those or either of those, we hope you'll call right now at 244-9455. And to help us work toward this challenge, we've heard from Bernice Russell of Crystal Lake and Greg Marshall of Serena. So a couple of calls in, and somebody's on the phone right now. So join them right now, 244-9455.
And it is, I guess I feel compelled to remind people once again, it is very important as time goes along here. We have seen some very significant reduction in our money that we get from the government, from the state and federal government. We don't know what our money from the federal government is going to be yet. It may be some months before we know, but we've been told by the dean of the College of Communications that we should expect a 4% reduction in our state funding in the next year and the year after that and maybe the year after that. And that's on top of something like $330,000 of cuts we have absorbed within the last couple of years. Now, that's kind of grim news, but the good news is that you, who are listening to me right now, can do something about that. In fact, you're really the only person that can, by saying, yeah, I believe in this station and what they do. I believe in it enough so that I'm going to call 244-9455 and give them some money. The money that will pay for the programs next year. And I guess, Dave, you know, on here, on the radio and on television, one of the things we always encourage people is to think of this as kind of an investment, because the return on the investment, well, it's the programs that they listen to and that they watch.
Well, and it's an investment for the entire community. And we want to stress, too, that if you are not currently a friend of WILL, you are doubly important. Not that current friends aren't important, but new friends are important, because we need to keep the number of friends up. We need to keep as many as people as possible in this organization and contributing members. And so, you know, if you have not made a contribution before, please do give us a call now on the last weekday of this drive.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break here, as we usually do. We will have news from National Public Radio at 1 minute past the hour. Before that, an update on the markets. So please stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL.